And good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's just great to be back. Thank you for letting me come back. I kind of needed the rest this summer, I think. I found out I had an ulcer, and you have to go do one of those endoscopies. I don't know, they're fun. They're not bad. And along with the ulcer was some anemia. And when I started taking iron supplements, my energy level came up where it hasn't been in years. So that's kind of good. So don't be afraid of running into the hospital for little things like that. The notes are really extraordinary. There's 14 weeks of notes. Discovery Publishing did them for us, and they could easily have been $10, $12 for the whole set, but Robin Yee did them for $3, which is really a labor of love. And it's really Ray's book, Beyond Suffering. Extraordinarily fine sermons, long out of print. Let's see when this was issued in 81. Well, Job is perennial, so it doesn't much matter. A couple of people ask me how the Mormons are. Every single Friday, all summer long, I've had two, usually four Mormons show up at Friday at my house. They used to stay an hour, now they tend to stay 2 hours at least. A couple of weeks ago, they wanted to know about the Gadarene, Jesus calming the Sea of Galilee and going over to Gadara and casting the demons out into the pigs and making deviled ham and things like that. So we got out Luke and we read through. I had them read those chapters of Luke, and we had a very lively discussion with them about what it must have been like to be there. And then this last Friday, we got onto the sufferings of Jesus. So I had them read Isaiah 53 and 54 and Psalm 22, and I had them read it from their King James, and I had my New King James, and I said, well, you know, that's just almost verse for verse like my New King James. There's only two words on there that are different, and they're archaic, and this is all my little ploy to get them to recognize that their old and antiquated King James is not the only Bible, which, of course, Joseph Smith insists that it is. And these kids are all 19, 20 years old. They're really friendly now that we're all good friends, first name basis. And the kind of high point of my week, because they're so open and so teachable, and I don't think I can go find 19, 20-year-olds here at the church that are that open. That's not a slam at our young people. It's a slam at the culture, because at least these Mormon kids have great values, and they're very they're dedicated and they're teachable. And they're not set in concrete. At that age, they're not into all the deeper things of Mormonism, which are occultic, as you probably know. So as long as we keep talking about Jesus and who he is and what he's done, we generally have a very lively time. So now call up your local Mormon church and say you'd like some missionaries to visit you and just serve them a beverage. And I found out they drink a lot of Pepsi-Cola. They're not supposed to have caffeine, but they do allow it. And a lot of my old misconceptions about Mormonism just aren't true anymore. So find out for yourselves, and they're really, really nice guys, nice kids. And they could come over to your living room and just have a really nice talk. Okay, Job, the book of Job. The oldest book in the Bible, most likely. Not the first written book in the Bible. We don't know when it was written or by whom exactly. However, it is the most difficult Hebrew that is in existence. And it has a lot of loan words. This book has attracted a lot of interest down through the years. John Calvin liked it so much he preached 139 sermons on the book of Job. We're going to do that in 14 weeks. And I don't know if Calvin was boring after 139 sermons, but he probably had a lot to say. Alfred Lord Tennyson, the great, wonderful English poet, said that he considered this the grandest poem, whether ancient or modern. The book of Job opens with a section of prose, closes with a section of prose, but the great middle piece is poetry. And the poetry uses a lot of borrowed words. There's six different Hebrew words for darkness in the book of Job. There's six different words five different words for lion and six different words for trap in this book. And there are borrowed words from Akkadian, from Arabic, from Aramaic, from Sumerian, and from Ugaritic languages. So it's just full of loan words that have been pulled in. The name of God that's most prominent in this book, that's used 31 times, is the name Shaddai, Almighty, All-Sufficient One. El Shaddai, All-Sufficient. And so 31 times in Job, but only 17 times in the whole rest of the Old Testament. And that's kind of interesting. And Job's mentioned in James as the man who had great perseverance. And he's mentioned in Ezekiel, along with Daniel and Noah, as heavy-duty righteous dudes. Remember what Ezekiel said, that even if Daniel, Noah, and Job were right here, I still wouldn't save anybody but them, because you guys are all such losers. So that's the kind of class of people that Job is in, and where he's considered. This book has absolute profundity, and it's got a lot of surprises. If you can hang through some of these long discourses by Job's friends, I think you'll find that this book is just loaded with insights into life, and it doesn't answer all the questions of suffering, but it answers some, and it gives us a lot of insights. The most amazing thing about this book, and it's the only book in the whole Bible that gives us a behind-the-scenes glimpse of what's going on in the heavenly places, behind the scene of life. Disasters happen to us, tragedies, suffering, hardship, and we have no reason why. Well, in this book, we get to look into the realm of the angels and God, and we get to see that sometimes that something's going on that we don't have a clue about. The opening chapters here don't make a lot of sense at first and won't make a lot of sense till we get to the end of the book. Okay? All set? Interrupted any time? There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. Uz is most likely down in southern Edom, southern part of Edom. That would be southern Jordan. That's probably where it was. And it would have been a rich pasture land. And when Esau was there long years later, he prospered with flocks and crops and so on. So that's the setting, and we're pretty sure that's where he lived, in the Middle East, and probably not too long after Abraham. If Abraham lived 2200 BC, 4200 years ago, that's why this is the oldest book. And you'll see it in the language, and in some of the things in here fit a world that's just recovering from the flood and just bouncing back and getting repopulated, and it's before Israel came into existence, before the law of Moses. And yet, here's a very godly man. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. Tells us right away that he was a righteous man, and he would have been righteous because of his faith in God and what he knew about God and the promises of God. It does not mean that he was sinless, that he'd never sinned. He was blameless, which meant that he had dealt with all the sin that he was aware of. Paul says that in the New Testament, I don't know anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. But if I become aware of something in myself that needs dealing with, then I'll hand it over to God. But in the meantime, God's statement here about the man is that he's blameless and upright, and he feared God, and he ran away, turned away from evil, which is a pretty high testimony about this man. He lived a long time too, as we'll see a little bit later on. And he had seven sons and three daughters. So by this time, when the story starts, the sons and daughters are grown up and they have their own homes and their own family. So he's probably already reasonably older. And he's a very rich man. His possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. That is many, many servants and workers. And this man was the greatest of all of the people of the East. In his whole area, he was well known as rich and prosperous and godly and reputable, thoroughly reputable. So he's a very important guy. And, yeah. Well, the early biblical history settles in the Middle East. You know, after the flood, mankind starts spreading out from Babylon and what's now Iraq, and beginning to move out, and that's the populated part of the world at this time. Probably the European the area of Europe hadn't started to be populated very much, and so the most important civilization was still in that local area. And remember that the Bible is pretty much well built around Israel and the Middle East, and the Bible doesn't bother to tell us a lot of what's going down in New Zealand or Australia or Samoa. It just sort of leaves that all out. We have to get used to that God doesn't tell us everything about everybody. Seven sons and three daughters, and a lot of possessions, and his sons would go and feast in their houses on his appointed day, on his birthday. And he would send and invite the three sisters to eat and drink with him. So this is a tight-knit family of seven brothers and three sisters, and when it's birthday time for one of the sons, they throw a party, and all the sons and daughters gather together. And so it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, pray over them, bless them. He would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. He'd offer burnt offering for every one of his children. This, if you remember Leviticus, this is not the whole burnt offering. This is the sin offering that takes care of individual sins, whether deliberate or inadvertent. That's, remember Leviticus? Leviticus is on the final exam. So you're going to have to go back and read that. And the reason that Job offered these sacrifices on the birthdays of his sons, he says here, is, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Job did regularly. So he's a really loving father, and he is so concerned about the lives of his sons that he offers sacrifices on their behalf. He prays for them. He intercedes for them. He's very, very concerned that they're living godly lives. Pretty, pretty neat father. Couldn't find any fault with that. Now, we get behind the scenes. Suddenly it switches into the world of the invisible, into the world the New Testament calls the heavenly places, the spiritual realm, not far away. It's just pull back a curtain in this room and we can see this world, and here we're allowed to look into it. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Sons of God in the Old Testament, Bene Elohim, always means angels. In the New Testament, sons of God can mean Christians, believers. But in the Old Testament, whenever you see that term sons of God, it means angels. Like back in Genesis 6, when there was this intermarriage between angels and the daughters of Eve and caused no end of problems. So here we're looking into the courtroom of heaven, and there comes a day when God's there and the angels come together before God. You know, angels, millions of angels come in to talk to God, and we see here suddenly that Satan is allowed to come into the presence of God. The name here, first time we find the word Satan so explicitly, it's ha-satan in Hebrew, and it means the adversary. Whom later on we find was kind of the original prime minister of the universe before he fell, and he rebelled against God and wanted to take over the throne of God, but his original place of responsibility was really, really high up among the archangels in the universe, and he is now fallen. And right away we get some wonderful help, because we see that there's not two gods. There's not a god of good and a god of evil, which was dualism, which is false. We see that the evil in the universe is concentrated around Satan, and Satan is very limited. And we get some wonderful help here. Satan has to do things by permission. He's not allowed to run rampant, out of control. And when he is given permission to do anything, it's limited. You can do this, 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 and this. How's that for comfort? What if this guy was turned loose and allowed to do whatever he wanted? Well, we'd be slaughtered in a minute, because he hates us and he's a murderer. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where do you come from?" So God starts the conversation going by talking to Satan, who's in his presence, and Satan's in his presence even now today. And he usually, from the book of Revelation, we find that he usually likes to go into the presence of God to accuse the believers, to rat on us and to accuse us. That comes up with the book of Revelation, and the saints overcome him by the word of their testimony and the blood of their lamb. Remember that in the book of Revelation. Well, here, God starts a conversation with Satan and says, "Hey, what you been doing lately, dude?" And Satan says, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Be sober, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, goes around like a roaring lion seeking someone he may devour." So Satan says, "Well, I've been roaming around on the earth." Well, why is he roaming around on the earth? Because he's the god of this world, the god of this age, because that's his territory. Because he stole it away from Adam and Eve. And he's kind of got himself in here as the manager of the culture of the world. That's kind of sobering. Who's running things around here pretty much? Well, the devil is. Except that God's over him. So right away you can see that if there's a lot of things that are bad in the world right now, that are, where there's a lot of deceit and a lot of hatred and a lot of murder and a lot of violence, where is it coming from? It's coming from this bad guy. And that's already a help. Not all the bad things in the world are coming directly from Satan, but some of them are. And as a roaring lion, he'd love to get at each one of us. But most of the time, God protects us, we see here. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. Take a look at my servant Job." Now, that's kind of provocative that God would do that. But he brings Job up, and look what God says about him. He's blameless, and he's upright, and he fears God, and so he runs away from evil, just like it says back in the first verse. And so this is my exhibit A. I would like just to call your attention to this godly man. And Satan says, "Ha, ha, ha. Does God fear Job for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and possessions have increased in the land." The reason Job blesses you is because you've made him rich and prosperous and happy and successful, and you've given him all this great stuff. Well, anybody in that situation couldn't help but be grateful. So that doesn't really... So your guy, Job, we don't know anything about his motives, but the reason that he's so positive about you is because you're protecting him and blessing him so much. The devil really wants to get at Job and Job's motives. And Satan says, "Now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. Take away his possessions, and then you'll see what Job's really like. He'll yell at you and curse you and insult you big time. That's what I think." And God says, "Okay, let's find out. Let's see if he really does curse me." Man, God's given this bad guy an awful lot of latitude in the life of this righteous man. Who's going to win? And Satan's got all of his money on the fact that he's going to win this one, that Job's motives are going to turn out to be evil, and sure enough, when his property's taken away from him, he'll curse God. So he really wasn't so righteous after all. All right. "The Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person.'" There's the limit. Okay, Satan, have a go, but don't you dare touch this man's life and his integrity, as his integrity biologically and as a person. That's kind of neat, because Satan would love, of course, to come right in and just shred everything, including Job. And God says, "No, you can't do that, but I'm giving you access to his life to do whatever you want to do. Go ahead and do your worst, and let's see how Job handles this." And it happens quickly. Satan went out from the presence of the Lord in glee, probably in delight. And suddenly, we switch back now into the scene in Job's life. there was a day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. Nothing wrong with that. And a messenger came to Job and said, "Oh, master, guess what happened today? The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding, and the Sabaeans raided them and took them away, and they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped with you." The Sabaeans are the people that later inhabit Sheba down in southern Arabia. We're going to run on to the Chaldeans in a minute. And they were nomadic tribes really, really early, and later on they settled down. So this is another clue that this is a very old book. So there's a marauding bunch of Sabaeans that came in and took all the oxen and the donkeys and killed Job's servants who were taking care of the animals. So the first messenger comes right in and says, "Oh, we've got some really drastic news from this corner of your territory." And while the first servant, was still speaking, another came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." You know, disasters don't tend to come one at a time. They come to cascade. Did that happen to you? It's not one thing goes bad, it's everything goes bad. You get in a car accident, and then the dishwasher won't run, and somebody calls you up and says, "You got to stop what you're doing and come and help me," and then you get bad news from a relative that's sick. This all happens in one day. It doesn't scatter it out over time. This is cascading right fast. And this fire coming down from heaven could well have been something like a lightning strike or something like that. We don't know what it is, but it's sudden and dramatic. And then yet a third servant comes running in. While he was still speaking, even before the first two servants have gotten all the news out, comes number three and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, took them away, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Well, that's pretty horrible news, because his wealth is all wiped out in one dramatic drop of the stock market here, because he's broke. Now, yet the fourth servant comes. While he was still speaking, another servant came and said, "Oh, I've got some really horrific news. Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking in their oldest brother's house." The oldest brother invited them over for Sunday dinner or Sabbath dinner or whatever. And they were just having a great time of fellowship. And suddenly a great wind came from heaven across the wilderness. Sounds like a tornado. And struck the four corners of the house. And it fell on the young men, and they are dead. And I also have escaped to tell you. Probably the daughters too. Yeah. Suddenly all of his 10 kids that he loves and he's so devoted to are dead. And the house has fallen on him, and that's it. What more could possibly go wrong? Everything has gone wrong. What does Job do? Now's the time for him to curse God. Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground, and he worshipped. That's pretty. Would you do that? If this happened to you in your life and you suddenly lost everything in a minute and you stop and you say, "Thank you, Lord, for all the good things that you've done for me, and thank you for this calamity that's come upon me and I don't understand it and this is terribly painful." But that's what he did. Did he curse God? Nope. And what did he say? He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb and naked shall I return. I came into the world with nothing. I'm going to leave the world with nothing. God's blessed me in the meantime. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Isn't that neat? To hold on to your possessions so lightly and to be willing to lose them all and not blame God. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. The score now is Job 1, Satan 0, right? So Job does not curse God like the devil said he would. He doesn't curse God at all. He handles this incredibly well, and that only just establishes his righteousness and his integrity. So Satan loses the first bet. Is he going to give up? No, not going to give up. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. That seems to happen periodically and regularly, not all the time, but Satan seems to have be able to walk into the high courts of heaven and enter into the conversation with all the other angels and with God. The Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause?" You wanted to destroy him without any cause whatsoever, and I let you do that, and what does it prove? So, Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life." Oh, well, if he's in good health and he's alive and he can start all over again and his wife's still around, he'll go build a new life, and he's in good health and vitality, so... But if anything happened to his health or to his physical well-being, well, that's another story. Now Job is not going to bless you and love you. He's going to curse you. Yes, does God play loose with his people? Is this a game? Is this a poker game or some kind of a betting game? It seems like it, doesn't it? And could this happen to you? Is it whimsical? Is it arbitrary? Yeah. It seems like it doesn't take very much to get God to say, "Okay, I'll turn you loose. I'll let you wreck this person's life." So we got to figure now that if you want to read ahead, I think let's just put this in up front here. There is purpose in God allowing this, and the purpose is to get Job deeper in his relationship with God, to help Job see things about himself that he hasn't seen and perhaps cannot see any other way than to go through this trial, and this trial is allowed for his ultimate blessing and good, so it is not purposeless. In fact, I give you a real big clue to this whole book. At the beginning of the book, we have three principal characters: God, Job, and Satan. The end of the book, what do you have? God and Job. No Satan. Kind of a little bit of clue that when God's really happy with you, Satan has no access to you at all. But so why is this happening? It won't be clear for a long time. We're going to dig that all out. And why it is so calamitous. If there's things in Job's life that are out of order, why didn't he just send him an email or a little memo or just say, "Hey, look, Job, you're doing great, but I got a few little things. Would you correct them?" Well, it's not how this goes. All right, where were we now? "Stretch out your hand against him and touch his bone and his flesh," says Satan, "and then he'll curse you. Let something happen to his health and his physical well-being." And so the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he's in your hand, but spare his life." Nephesh. Soul. That suggests that he even could come down to the point of real close to physical death. So you can do as much damage as you want, but you're not allowed to end his life. A lot of latitude for the devil to go to work on this guy. And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, delighting at what he's allowed to do, and he immediately strikes Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Anybody ever had boils? Awful, painful, terrible infections that are hard to cure, and one is bad enough, I remember my father, when I was a boy, had a couple of boils on his neck, and it was agonizing night and day, and they just don't easily go away. And don't ask God to let you have any boils. And he's got them all over his whole body here. And he takes a potsherd, a scrap of broken pottery, to scrape himself, to scrape the pus and ooze out of these ugly, painful boils. And he goes and sits down in the ashes, ash heap outside of his house. And there's some suggestion here that maybe if you put ashes all over your body, it takes away, it takes away some of the pain of the boils. It kind of helps a little bit. But it's certainly a picture of utter humility, humiliation and degradation to be covered with ugly open sores and to be no longer the master of this great estate, but to be sitting out in the ash heap where you dump the ashes from the fireplace. And his wife. Now, there's a lot. I wish that we had Mrs. Job's side of this thing. How do you suppose she feels when her 10 kids are suddenly killed? He thinks that's neutral for her? Oh, no, not the way mothers care for their kids. This has got to be anguish. What about all the fancy new appliances she had in her kitchen and all the servants she had to help? And they're not there, and she's got to do the dishes and the laundry and everything. And I wish I could read a book from Mrs. Job and say, my experiences as Mrs. Job. But when we get to heaven, we can sit her down and say, let me see how it was from your point of view. The trouble with these patriarchal books, you know, there's a lot going on here in the family that we don't hear about. His wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Not very helpful. But then it's certainly understandable. Good heavens, how would you feel if you were Job's wife in this situation and all this has happened? And she is actually saying exactly what the devil has said. She doesn't know that, but that's exactly what the devil's case before God is. And she's actually suggesting that if you just get this over with, just go ahead and curse God, which is what the devil wants. And Job says, he's actually quite kind. It sounds like he's calling her a fool here. He says, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. But it's really not that harsh. It's the word's Nabal. We know a guy named Nabal in the New Testament. And it really means somebody who's not informed or doesn't have the whole picture or is speaking without having thought something through. So it's not, he's not putting his wife down, really. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? God does give us a lot of good, but can't we handle adversity if he sends it to us, even if we don't know why it's come to us? That's pretty mature, pretty godly way to handle it. I don't understand why this calamity has happened, but God's allowed it. Do I believe in a good God, a benevolent God? No, he didn't. Job doesn't know what we know. We already know more than him. We know what's gone on in heaven with Satan, and he doesn't. He doesn't have a clue as to why this happened, but at the same time, he says, God is sovereign, and God brings good into our lives, and God allows calamity. And we may not understand why the calamity has hit us, but let's not rush right out and curse God and blame God, because we don't have all the facts. That's one of the neat things about this book, that we're going to get some clues later on as to why this happened to Job. It isn't going to explain all the other kinds of suffering that we see every day, but it's a huge help in looking at the whole picture. And there's a wonderful lesson in here, and that is don't complain. When bad things happen to you, look at the fact that God's got some great, higher, wonderful purpose for you, his beloved children. Now, if you look at the non-Christian world and bad things happen to those people out there, that's a little different. But we're God's children, and he loves us, and he cherishes us, and he wants only good for us. His goal is wholeness for us. So if you can just stop in the hard times and thank God, as Job did. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Score? Job 2, Satan 0. Okay, Satan, you've had your say, and you're wrong. You're totally wrong. Job, is blameless. He has total integrity. He did not curse me, no matter how bad it was. You lost. Now we switch back to earth again. Job's most important man in the whole region. Very, very wealthy landowner with this big family and all this reputation. And the news gets out. It's in the morning paper, the Us Herald Tribune. And the emails are all buzzing with the news from Us that this terrible thing has happened to Job. The whole surge of calamities that hadn't happened to anybody else in the area. And when Job's three friends, he's got three really neat lifelong friends, really neat people, you'll see. If you think the worst has happened to Job, you're wrong. There's more bad stuff to come, and it's going to come from his three, quote, friends. But we'll get into that. We'll start on that next week. Job's three friends heard of all his adversity that had come upon him, and each came from his own place. They don't live in the same town. Eliphaz the Temanite, that's part of Edom. Bildad the Shuhite, that's the shortest man in the Bible. I think that John Anik would remind us that he's the shortest man. He's only shoe height. I didn't invent that. That comes from that's Aniker. Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment. They sent emails to each other, and they said, hey, let's all get together and take a bus and go over and visit Job. You know, they got on their donkeys, and they're going to go and visit Job for a long stay. They're going to go over there and help him. They had made an appointment together to come and to mourn with him and to comfort him. So they come with all the right motives. What can we do for our friend Job? We better go identify with him in his suffering and his sorrow, and let's go comfort him. So they start out with exactly the right motives. That's what you'd like three friends to do if this happened to you, wouldn't you? Well, we'll see how they behave when they actually get there. We'll see if they really come through, and see how this story ends. If you want to read ahead, if you can't wait, and this is too much like a soap opera, and you can't wait for next week, you can read ahead. And what do these friends do? They raised their eyes from far, and they did not recognize him. As soon as they came over the hill and they saw the ruins of his estate, and they saw Job out there in the ash heap, and they could tell from a distance that everything was devastated, they lifted their voices and they wept. That's the Eastern way of expressing anguish and overwhelming disaster. Each tore his robe, sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. These are godly men, are supposed to be, and so they're deeply distressed. They sat down with Job on the ground 7 days and seven nights. No one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. That's really amazing to sit 7 days and seven nights in front of this friend and not have one word to say, be so overwhelmed to not even to be say hi Job, how are you, or gee, this is a terrible tragedy. And they're so overwhelmed that they just sit there quietly and with Job to be there for 7 days and seven nights before any conversation starts. Pretty interesting. Pretty hard to imagine a more horrendous set of disasters all piling up all at once. And no obvious explanation for all this. And now how are we going to unravel this? Next week. Start unraveling it. Okay? What does this bring to mind now that we have this little... What do you think about? What comes to mind? Yeah. That's exactly right, and that is such a common attitude, isn't it? in the Christian world today that you expect God will only bless you and that only good things happen to God's people. We've got whole churches that are built on the prosperity gospel and on giving you advice so that you do better in your job and you have a happy marriage and nothing tragic ever happens to you. And you're God's people, so why should he do anything other than bless you? And that the book of Job shoots that argument down right away. Why shouldn't bad things happen to you? Especially since we're sinners and we didn't deserve to be saved in the first place. Why didn't God just wipe us all out? When did he say, I'm fed up with you guys. I'm a holy God. I'm a great God. I cannot tolerate any sin at all. The human race is really messed up big time. Why should I do anything for you wretched sinners? Well, we also, this is Old Testament. Job also doesn't have the news of who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. He doesn't have the degree of comfort that we get from the New Testament. The Psalms haven't been written yet. He's operating only on the basis of what his experience with God has been. Yeah, that's really interesting. Where did he get his teaching from? Bible wasn't written yet. How much did Adam and Eve know? A lot. Did Adam and Eve set their children out and teach them? Yes. Adam and Eve sat Cain and Abel down and taught them about sacrifices and about God and about sin and imparted a great deal of information, and Adam knew a lot about God, and it got passed all the way down to Noah, and the whole world falls apart in the time of Noah, and Noah and his three sons did plenty of praying and listening to the traditions that had come down from the 10 generations from Adam, and they get off the ark, and Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their wives have got to repopulate the whole earth. And are these godly parents? Oh, yes, indeed they are. They've seen the whole world destroyed. There's no nonsense about their relationship with God. They're going to teach their kids everything they know about the Lord. They're going to pray with their kids. They're going to offer sacrifices. First thing Noah did when he got off the ark was to offer sacrifices. He knows who God is. And he's passed that on down to his kids, particularly Shem is going to pass it on down so that eventually gets to Abraham. When we meet Abraham, he's lapsed into paganism along with the rest of his family, but God reminds him. So there's an oral tradition right from the beginning of history that everybody everywhere in the whole world knows who God is, and it gets passed on down to the next generation, and there's traces of it of that early knowledge in every religion, little remnants of that, right? So no man in any generation is without excuse. And evidently, he knew a lot about God, yeah.
I think if you look at that theology, too, specifically Noah might have still been alive somewhere else. Because Noah
This is not too long, and we can speculate about this, not too long after the flood, and it's hard to tell how long, how much time has elapsed. So there's probably a good deal of oral tradition running around about the previous 1,000 years of history, or 1,500 years since the flood, or something. Yes, and we're nestled in the part of the world that was just emerging. The world just repopulating after the flood, and there's a godly remnant there, godly remnant, and he's one of the godly remnant. Pardon me? Oh, Satan using women in the Bible. Well, Satan, Eve was deceived, and Satan picked the woman to pick on because that was a little bit easier for him to con her into his plan to eat the forbidden fruit. But Adam was all too ready to agree with that and go along with that, and he didn't show much resistance. But it all comes back to headship. And it comes back to all these things in the Bible about men in leadership come from Adam and Eve. And Adam is the appointed head and steward of the creation, and Eve is his companion and his helper. And they're equal. They're totally equal. But they have different roles. And this is why we have male elders in the church. And if we have women pastors, they're under male heads. Are equal, totally, fully equal. That's why I'm so anxious to hear Mrs. Jobe's side of things. And I would be a little nervous myself about a woman president, but in a world, in a culture where only a few percent of the people are Christians, the rest of the world secular, it could happen, couldn't it? Women can do really, really fine jobs in secular leadership. What's her name's new book is on Hewlett Packard's coming out tomorrow. So I'm comfortable flying in an airplane with a woman in the cockpit. It doesn't bother me any. I'm fine. He didn't listen to his wife. Yeah. That's in this case. It's good. That's what God, when God called Adam into court and accused Adam, he said two things to Adam. He said, you did two things wrong. You didn't listen to me and obey me, and you listened instead to your wife. And that's what I'm holding you accountable for. Listening to your wife so that she could lead you astray, and disobeying me. So that's what he gets. The blame for the fall of the world is laid on Adam. It's not laid on Eve. He carries the brunt of it, even though it didn't start with him. So that's kind of male headship. Something goes wrong in your family, God puts it on dad. I'm so disgusted with all the lousy dads in our culture today that don't know how to raise kids, don't know how to protect daughters, don't know how to be loving to their wives, don't know how to take responsibility to be heads of the family. I've got a real case against a lot of dads and broken homes and hurting kids and all the moms that are raising kids without a sign of a father around. That's just I'm on a rant now and I've got to stop that. Rant on, he says. Is this okay so far? God is absolutely, totally sovereign. Satan is not a big deal because he has to do things only by permission of God. God allows Satan to do some bad things in the world, even to believers. Already we're going to say that great good is going to come out of this, but we can't see it yet. We don't know anything at all about what God really wants to deal with in Job. It's going to unfold in a wonderful way, and the book is going to have a very happy ending. Very happy ending. There's already a great deal that you can just be comfortable about, although we don't know how this is going to unravel. Okay? Everybody? Yeah, John. Okay. Oh, yes, we have some really goodies out there today. That does make a difference. Read ahead, and do read Ray's notes. Ray is superb on this. Just $3 for the whole 14 weeks. And go get your friends. Drag your friends in that are bored with church, and we'll try to liven it up. And I'll try to get in some real heresies that you can refute. And let's deal with the real hard questions you have. Let's just see if we can't put light on them. From the God of all comfort, who comfort you in all hard times and trials and suffering. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Well, yes, it makes you a little afraid that maybe God would do this to you today. Satan might go up and say, hey, I'd like to have a little permission to try so-and-so. And we're probably not anywhere near as godly as Job, so maybe we really deserve to get zapped like this, only maybe even worse. And do we have any assurance that this wouldn't happen to us? Well, we don't really. Except that we have some pretty strong promises in the New Testament, and we have Jesus interceding for us, and we have the Holy Spirit in us, and we have a lot of protection. It's obvious today that you have that in general we're greatly protected. And if something bad happens to you, it's because God wants to bring good out of it. It is not whimsical. God's not going to be conned into doing something and cause you any needless suffering for which there is no purpose. If something bad happens to you, there is a greater, it has something greater in mind, and a greater blessing lies ahead. And that's why you count it all joy when you meet various trials, James says. Count it all joy. Consider it all joy. So do what Job does. Lord, I thank you for this horrible calamity today, and the roof fell in, and everything's gone bad in my life. But I thank you because I know you're going to solve this, and I know you're going to bring something good out of it, and help me to go through the unraveling of this. Something bad happens, the first thing you do, go to God and say, look, I don't know why this happened. Help me. Let's work on this. I know that you are loving. I know that you don't mean me any harm. I know that you bring only want my good and my wholeness out of this. Let's go. Okay.
It reminds me of when the man came to Jesus and his son was dying, and he said, you know, help me with my unbelief. And that's kind of what is going on here. Mm-hmm. You know, when bad things happen to you, you have to, you know, put your trust in and believe what God says.
You do. And isn't it interesting that we have this prologue on here that we get to see what's going on behind the scenes, and Job's totally oblivious to all this. He doesn't have a clue as to why this has happened. He's doing everything as best he can, and yet it happens to him. Okay, yes. Yeah. God does put a hedge around us. He does. We are all greatly protected. The devil would like to get at any one of us, and we are greatly protected by God. So you can pray for that every morning. Lord, keep me close to you. Keep me safe. Protect my loved ones. Keep us clean. And please help us to deal with sin when we become aware of it. And keep growing and learning. Yeah, we do that. Well, we'll quit for today. Read ahead. Please read ahead. We've got some poetry to start unraveling next week. Our Father, thank you for the book of Job. Thanks for preserving this ancient document and handing it to us. This just incredible, one-of-a-kind book on suffering and on the problems of your sovereignty and free will and calamities and disasters in our lives. And I pray that you just, that all this, our time in Job would result in our walking closer to you, knowing you more deeply and more fully, accepting hardship and trial when it comes to us, even though we don't understand it. May we see, as Job did, that beyond all of our trials and suffering, there is a great, holy, loving God who is making us into whole new people, and that the end of the story of our lives will be blessed, even though today we don't see that. So thanks so much for our time together, the freedom we have together, and the story of the book of Job. And we just invite you, Lord, to watch over us this week and protect us and speak to us and just give us thoughtful meditation on this book. Watch over all of us and comfort us, Lord, and the rough things that happen to us. Thank you for the intimate presence of the Lord Jesus with us in everything that we do. We pray in his name. Amen.